This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Richard Williams, who is the chief sports writer for The Guardian. You can read his writings at theguardian.co.uk. And as I mentioned in the interview I did with Sean Engel, the sports editor for guardian.co.uk, I really believe that the coverage on The Guardian is the exceptional site for looking at the World Cup 2010 in all of its dimension, because there is so much dimension on the Guardian website about the World Cup, looking at the event from almost every facet with a torrent of information. But right at the center are the essays by Richard Williams, the chief sports writer for The Guardian. And Richard Williams' background is also in writing about music, and formerly also worked at Island Records, a little bit interesting since yesterday we interviewed Ziggy Marley on The People's Game. But we won't be talking about that with Richard Williams. We'll be talking about the 2010 World Cup tournament, the games on the field, and his take on how this tournament has gone so far and what he thinks about the upcoming final. Now, in your recent writing, Richard Williams, what I've really seen is a really serious effort to sort of analyze how the state of the game at the international level in terms of how it flows. And what I sort of see is a central tenet of what you've brought out, especially as the team sort of got pared down to fewer and fewer left in the tournament, is a sense that in 2010, international soccer is defined by pragmatism, and yet the one team that really still runs on creative flair is alive, and that's Spain. So your thoughts on how that's evolved?
Well, Alan, I think that's absolutely right. Over the course of the 64 games of the World Cup, of course, you get a very clear view of what's happening at the top of international football, and themes certainly do emerge. I think that's been a slight disappointment this time around, that so many teams seem to be doing the same thing or similar things in similar ways. And of course, one of the joys of the World Cup is the contrast you get of styles between the football from different continents. But of course, now with players crossing national frontiers so much, you know, so many players from Africa and South America and North America too playing in Europe, in the European leagues, it's inevitable that you get a kind of convergence. And of course, we all see so much soccer on the TV now that coaches and players can see what's happening around the world, can take the best of what's happening, can take the best ideas and adapt them to their own thinking. So here in South Africa, the biggest theme to me that's emerged has been the general preference for a 4-2-3-1 formula, which involves using two holding midfield players in front of your four-man defense to provide a screen before you begin attacking, if you like. You create this very, very solid rear guard using six players. You know, that's more than half the outfield team to protect your goalkeeper. Now, that's something that's been evolving for several years. You know, I remember being startled when Carlos Alberto Parreira, the Brazil coach, used it to win the World Cup in 1994. Mm-hmm. That seemed a very uncharacteristic thing for Brazilians to do, but it certainly worked. That wasn't the most exhilarating Brazilian team of all time, for sure, but it won the World Cup. And other coaches have picked that up, and now it's become almost universal. It doesn't mean that the football can't be exciting. You still have three created midfield players and one striker, and it depends on how inventive and creative they can be. In the case of Spain, you can see them being very creative indeed. It's going to be very interesting on Sunday to contrast that with Holland, who play the same shape but with a rather different attitude, with a more pragmatic, and that is the most used word of this World Cup, with a more pragmatic attitude.
Well, even before getting into the details, and it'll be interesting to look at how the Dutch and the Spanish sides have approached this tournament differently, and the fact that they both have their roots in total football coming out of Holland, particularly a legacy directly related to Johan Cruyff. But just sort of stepping back further in a broader lens, my sense of previous World Cups, with the exception, I mean, you look at 1990, very defensive-oriented in Italy, maybe it was, except for 1990, which it's a little hard for me to analyze closely. I remember it was a very defensive World Cup. But for the most part, in World Cup matches over the course of my lifetime, they open up at a certain point. The games, either a goal happens and then things really open up, or they just open up. And I think some of it may have to do with conditioning, but others may have to do with the fact that you look at the games now and the teams sort of spar for the first 20, 25 minutes. And that's sort of always been the case with teams that are relatively evenly matched. Also, I think more teams are more evenly matched now than used to be the case at World Cups. And however, with the way that it's organized now, the opening up never really seems to take place. And instead of having the teams feel each other out and then all of a sudden a breakthrough occurs or fatigue occurs and therefore the field opens up more, it seems like everybody's pacing themselves for the full 45 to 47 minutes of each half and the opening up never happens. And that does seem to be rooted in having six players play defensively.
Yes, I think there have been very, very rare exceptions to that in this World Cup. One of them was the game between Germany and England, which really did explode. But it exploded because England went behind and had to press for an equaliser against Germany and very unwisely left themselves undermanned at the back so the Germans could counterattack, which was very, very spectacular. But of course, it wasn't all out attacking. It was waiting for England to provide them with the opening. You're right that it hasn't opened up in that way. You know, we saw the traditional cagey first round of matches between the little mini leagues of four teams. That always happens. You know, nobody wants to get knocked out in the first round. Everybody wants to sort of protect themselves against that. And usually then things become more expansive. They haven't, but you're absolutely right that the teams are much more equal now. They can take fewer chances with each other. Going to be very interesting to see on Sunday if we get a more open game. I think the odds have to be heavily against that.
Well, of course, one of the big issues in global football in terms of its marketing and its reach has been the question of the American marketplace. And oddly, I do think a few of the games that did open up and were excited involved the American team because they had this compulsion to fall behind early and then were forced very dramatically to have to scramble back. And fortunately, they had the athletes in the back to contain the damage that was done on the counterattack. And eventually they did lose, however, when Guyon broke, just was simply had a spectacular play and was able to blow by Boca Negra and demerit. But at least for the American audiences, they got sort of thrills out of the World Cup because the games generally did open up more than they did for other teams.
Yeah, I think maybe it was circumstance, but the American team did seem to be built for drama more than most of the teams here. And I think they were pretty unlucky to catch Ghana on a rare night when they scored goals from open play. Ghana are a marvelous team. In my view, the last two World Cups, they've had the best midfield, you know, of any of the teams. But they just don't have anybody who can score goals on a regular and reliable basis. And unfortunately for the U.S., Guyon scored that absolutely wonderful goal. Very, very unusual. But the U.S. did provide a lot of drama. They always seemed prepared to go for it, even when they weren't behind. You know, they were not a cagey sort of team. Perhaps they have a greater awareness of the box office than some of the other teams, possibly knowing that they still have a very large public to convert, whereas pretty much all the other teams already, you know, their countries are already converted to soccer. It's the number one sport everywhere. But I think maybe the U.S. team were thinking about that too, or was slightly conditioned by that in a very healthy way, I have to say.
You've obviously been following World Cups probably your entire life. Is your sense that this is the largest, most followed World Cup in history? From being in the United States, it's hard not to sense that very much so, because this has been followed much more closely than the previous World Cup. What's your sense
of that? It's kind of, when you're actually in the middle of it, it's hard to assess the kind of worldwide reach of it. But certainly what one hears from at home in England and from around the world, they just get bigger and bigger. You know, my memory goes back kind of, when I was a boy, dimly to 1958, when it would hardly make a single column in the newspaper, really. It certainly wouldn't make the front pages. And now it's just every 4 years, it just becomes more and more dominant.
I'm speaking with Richard Williams. He is the chief sports writer for The Guardian newspaper and website, based in London, England, of course. And let's talk right now about the final. I want to return back to some of the sort of cultural themes and media effects of the World Cup towards the end of the interview. But let's look right now at what's coming up on Sunday. And it is a very intriguing match in particular because of the legacy that both teams have and the roots of that legacy in the total football that came out of Holland in the 1970s. Johan Cruyff, of course, was the great star of the Ajax teams that won European Cup championships in the early 70s, and then he, along with his cohorts, went to the finals against West Germany, where they lost to the home side. Cruyff skipped the 78 World Cup, but again, the Dutch team playing total football went to the finals, where again, they lost to the home side in the finals, Argentina. So they were, in that sense, unlucky, but it's hard to not look back at them as the top international side in the 1970s, given they lost two World Cup finals to home teams. And not to take that much away from those West German and Argentine teams that had great players as well and played some beautiful football. But they revolutionized the sport. And Johan Cruyff not only then went from Ajax to Barcelona to play, but in 1988 became the coach of Barcelona. And Barcelona became, as much as the top Dutch teams, a place where total football was practiced. Pep Guardiola, the current coach of Barcelona, sees himself as a disciple of Cruyff. And the core of this Spanish team comes out of the Barcelona side. So, and in contrast, the Dutch seem to have stepped back from playing that kind of total football. So there's this paradox, Holland versus Spain, and yet the practitioners of the great Dutch tradition more truly seem to be Spain. Your thoughts?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. This match, in a sense, is Holland versus Holland, and the team that's playing Dutch football is Spain. You can also think, when you're thinking of Barcelona, you can also think of Louis van Gaal, the coach, who was there for several years after Cruyff and before Guardiola. Now, he came out of Ajax, the same school as Cruyff. In a sense, he's a disciple of Cruyff and total football. And then Frank Rijkaard was there, another Dutch coach who came up through that sort of the Dutch Enlightenment, if you like. Mm-hmm. And Guardiola, of course, is continuing in the same path. And you see that in the way that there will be seven or eight products of Barcelona, mostly of Barcelona's academy in the Spain team on Sunday. And they play in a very beautiful, very creative, constructive kind of way that does have its root. It's not what we used to think of as total football in the early 70s, where backs became forwards became backs, midfielders did everything. It's not the fluidity of that has people have rethought that, because that was in the end an unrealistic way to play. It was wonderfully idealistic, but not couldn't really. It was an ideal, not a reality. But the adaptation of it is now what you see with Barcelona and Spain. Whereas in Holland, Bert van Marwijk, the current head coach of Holland, is not a product of the Ajax school. He's never even worked in Amsterdam. He worked for quite a lot. He was a player with several clubs outside Amsterdam, and he coached teams in small towns and then went on to Feyenoord. And his view is very different. It's that word pragmatic again. His view is the reason that Holland have lost two World Cup finals is that their defense wasn't good enough. And he says the same thing happened 2 years ago under Marco van Basten in the European Championships when it's the sort of Dutch tendency to overconfidence. They beat France and Italy brilliantly in the early matches, and then lost to Russia in the quarterfinals because they thought they were already through. All they had to do was kind of stroll through, and they'd get to the finals. And he says that when he took over 2 years ago, what he made very plain was that he was going to teach this team to defend. Before they could win matches, that's what they'd have to, or before they could win tournaments, that's what they'd have to learn how to do. Consequently, he's got a four-man back line. If you think back to the glory days of Dutch football, they very often played with a back three.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's got four defenders and two very, very strong, very tough, very ruthless and uncompromising defensive midfielders in front of that, mm-hmm. that four-man defense. And then in front of those, of course, he's got the four creative players. But it's very, very obvious where his priorities lie. And the contrast with Spain, who play the same formation with a very different attitude, is fascinating. They have two holding midfield players, if you like, mm-hmm. in Sergio Busquets of Barcelona and Xabi Alonso of Real Madrid. But Xabi Alonso, is although he sits deep, is primarily a creative player. He's there to do what we in Europe now call the quarterback role in a soccer team. He's there to play, to look, see what's happening ahead of him, to play the right long pass to get an attack moving, and occasionally to move forward himself, rather like Andrea Pirlo did with Italy,
mm-hmm.
Although not at this World Cup. And so the two teams play a similar structure, but with an entirely different attitude.
Well, if you look at the Dutch team, too, in spite of the fact that Van Bronckhorst hit that just sensational goal against Uruguay,
yep.
which, in fact, actually opened that match up, and that ended up nobody really anticipated that. They expected Uruguay to sort of suffocate without Suarez, but it was a somewhat open and entertaining match and a marvelous strike. But for the most part, the Spanish wing fullbacks move forward more than what you see from this current Dutch side. So you see Sergio Ramos, you see Capovilla up front. You also see Piqué run up through the middle, and of course they move. They're those two back defenders, central defenders, are their primary threats on set pieces in the air. And I don't think you see as much offensive contribution from the Dutch team. So even though they're not playing completely total football, where you expect, where you again would have had the defenders making even more of an offensive contribution, at least in theory, the Spanish team, even in that respect, I think does much more so than the Dutch team.
Yes, I think Sergio Ramos, in a way, does it to a fault. I mean, he's always up there in advanced positions on the right wing, and he's a wonderfully energetic and enthusiastic player, but he's not actually a right winger. And I think he gets himself into positions where he can't, so frequently, where he can't use the ball as well as a proper right winger would do.
Right.
Quite interesting to see that I think Jose Mourinho next year at Real Madrid is going to put him back in the center of defense, which is where he started. But certainly he adds, like John Capdevila on the left side, adds a terrific sense of dynamism to that side. And as you say, Piqué comes up through the middle. I think it was César Luis Menotti, the Argentina coach from 1978, who said a couple of weeks ago, he's here writing for a French newspaper, I think. He said that he thought Piqué was the best centre-back he'd seen since Franz Beckenbauer, with very similar attributes, you know, that makes those wonderful long runs up into through midfield into attack. And then you get Carlos Puyol, who, of course, came in to score that fantastic goal that settled the semi-final. I mean, that was not just a centre-back trundling up and, you know, nodding in a corner. That was a fantastically well-thought-out and well-angled run and a wonderful header. And, it may not have been, you know, a beautiful goal from David Villa or Andres Iniesta, but it was absolutely a goal worthy of settling a World Cup semi-final.
One of the things I'm thinking about looking at this final is the role that Ian Robin might play and whether the Spanish defense will be heading into the match, like previous opponents of Holland, willing to sort of tilt their defense to block off Robin as much as, again, the previous opponents have, which may create more space for Robin. I would argue, even though he hasn't had the greatest World Cup, on recent form, say the past 6 months, he is the exceptional offensive performer that'll be on the field as a singular talent. And again, that's somewhat of an odd mix, and I think he has been an odd mix on Dutch sides throughout his career, in his club history.
Yes, he has.
Right? But I think he could be sort of lurking in the background and could surprise some people on Sunday. And it's odd to think that the most famous offensive performer would then surprise people on a World Cup final, but he seems to have faded a little bit into the background again.
Yes, well, it was interesting in against Brazil in the quarterfinal, in the first half, they kind of gang marked him, mm-hmm. and they double and triple marked him, and he couldn't get anywhere. He was trying to turn inside and losing the ball. And then when the game got a bit stretched in the second half, he tore them apart. Mm-hmm. When he was up against a single marker,
right.
He was absolutely lethal, and he made the difference. And I think he can go quiet for long periods, but then when the moment is right, and the opposing defence is undermanned, when he finds himself one on one, then he's really going to cause trouble, and I'm sure he'll do that to. For Spain, he'll certainly restrict Capdevila's scope for going forward, that's for sure.
Speaking with Richard Williams, he is the chief sports writer for The Guardian newspaper and website based out of London. Well, Richard Williams, I thank you so much for going over that, because I think that was a great preparation for audiences out there listening and getting excited about this very intriguing strategic matchup between the Dutch and the true Dutch, who go under the name of Spain these days. And I want to go back a little bit in the tournament with you, because earlier on in the tournament, you wrote very pointedly about the failings of the English team. And they really seemed phenomenally flat. The premiership is, however, anything but flat. Why was it impossible for this team to bring the flair of the premiership style of play that no longer is boot it down the field and, you know, have your point man knock it down and hope Rooney runs onto it and boots it with hustle into the back of the net? Why was the more flowing, fluid, intricate passing game that you do see in the premiership, again, not total football, not what you get certainly in Serie A, not in the Bundesliga, it's still distinctive. But, you know, the style of the fast, open, intricate passing, no longer that many balls in the air is booted forward that you see in the premiership. Why was that style not in effect with the British side?
Well, you know, Fabio Capello has been paid $7 or $8 million a year to answer that question, and he hasn't come up with a solution. There are many possible answers. One of them, which he advanced and which I think can be knocked down without a qualm, is that the players were exhausted at the end of a long and arduous Premier League season. All the big teams in this tournament have had pretty much, except Germany, I think, have had Premier League representatives in their ranks, and they've all performed with bags of energy, as if they know they're at a World Cup and they know how important it is, and you know, forget what happened last season. Let's put everything into this. England's causes are more profound and less easy to diagnose, the causes of their horrible performance here. And it really was horrible, horrible to watch, actually, embarrassing. It's something to do with the sense of entitlement, with the egos, that they're all paid huge amounts of money. They're all huge stars in England and some of them around the world. And somehow, over the last few years, they've got themselves into the mindset that they're just entitled to come here and win these things.
Because they did so well in Euro. Because they did so well in Euro 2008, they of course assumed they would win this tournament. I mean, they didn't even qualify for Euro 2008.
But that doesn't seem to. That doesn't seem to have changed anything about their attitude. Once they got here, they did qualify for the World Cup extremely well.
Right.
They won 9 out of their 10 qualifying games, which is pretty good performance, and looked quite good, but it was not a very arduous qualifying group, one has to say. But everybody thought that Capello had got them organized, you know, into a sensible way of playing. I think there were too many old players in the side. Capello himself made quite a lot of mistakes, I think, in selecting the squad and then selecting the side. None of this explains what was wrong with Rooney as an individual, the one really outstanding world-class player in the team. And that was probably a legacy of the injury he suffered late in the season in the first leg of Manchester United's Champions League match against Bayern Munich. He suffered an ankle injury, came back from that probably a bit too quickly in order to serve the purposes of his club. And it's felt that might have hampered him a bit here. I think it was a bit more psychological than just that, actually. I mean, he seemed to be in a very, just in a very grumpy mood all the way through. So, you know, I don't think any of them enjoyed the experience of being here.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly because Capello imposed a very strict regime on them. They were in a rather remote place. There was nothing to go and see, and they weren't taken out to see. You know, you're in South Africa, it's a different place. You know, it does you good to go and look at what's around just to open your eyes a bit, and they didn't have any of that. They just were just stuck in the camp, told trained in the morning, told to go to bed in the afternoons. As far as I can see, none of them enjoyed that. They got bored and a bit fractious, and, you know, there was a sort of an abortive players' revolt at one point. And it was just all, it just felt very unhealthy. And the sort of, just the bad vibes kind of compounded themselves, and you could see that on the field.
I want to ask you now about, you know, what it means to be the sports writer for The Guardian, and how The Guardian, if at all, the sort of progressive political bent of the paper, you know, informs your writing or informs the general sports writing. And some of the, one of the reasons I ask this is because there's so much discourse on the World Cup. It's so immensely popular. It's obviously a highly significant social text and cultural text that humanity participates in right now like nothing else. So, yeah, what you make of that, if you bring that to bear at all in your sports writing?
Yeah, I feel I haven't written enough about that side of it or thought enough about that side of it while I've been here, frankly, because you're so occupied with thinking about the matches themselves, going to them, previewing them, watching them, trying to figure out what's happening, trying to tease out the kind of footballing undercurrents that, although one comes here with the best of intentions, some of those, I'm afraid, fall by the wayside. You know, it's... Nevertheless, you can't avoid the, how can I put it, the dissonance between the extreme affluence that's represented by the World Cup, by FIFA in particular, and by all these footballers, many of them extremely rich, coming to a country that is predominantly still extremely poor, where, you know, a huge majority of the population don't have flushing toilets, for instance, where, you know, many of them live in townships in tiny, tiny boxes made out of plywood and cardboard. And you see, of course, you couldn't avoid that even if you wanted to. You know, my second day here, I went to Soweto, which a lot of people have done while they've been here. I tried to go to one of the more remote bits and meet some kids who were playing football and try and see what their lives were like. And it's very, very salutary. Now, a World Cup can't solve that in any way. You hope that by showing South Africa in a good light, maybe there will be more inward investment in the country that can perhaps trickle down to the very poorest people and improve the quality of their lives. You have to question whether FIFA's insistence on building all these huge stadiums is the right way to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are two or three stadiums here that will have no serious useful life. They've cost, you know, hundreds of millions. They will have no serious useful life once the circus has packed up its tents and moved on. And I feel that absolutely can't be right, that the reuse and the refurbishment of already perfectly good stadiums like Ellis Park in Johannesburg and Loftus-Versfeld in Pretoria, which are, you know, a big, big rugby stadiums, because rugby, you know, has been the big sport here.
Mm.
That's, you know, a much more sensible thing to do. And just to plonk these gigantic constructions down in places where there can't be a function for them afterwards is wrong.
Now, there's something I haven't seen much made of yet, and I don't know if it's even appropriate that anything should be made of it. I'm not down in South Africa, and I can't say that I'm intricately aware of where the sort of lines of political demarcation lie in the society 16 years after the end of apartheid. But one of the paradoxes of the era, and I was a university student at the time, of the sort of great divestment movements around the world, the anti-apartheid movements, was you looked at Holland, you looked at the Netherlands, and saw this incredibly liberal society at the time, and then you paid attention to the situation in South Africa. And it certainly seemed like a lot of the people who were most stringently defending the apartheid system had Dutch surnames and were Afrikaners. And it seemed, I'm sure there's a million paradoxes and ambiguities here, that the Afrikaner community was was the part of the white community that was most defending the apartheid system, and that there were roots in that regard. Has any of that come up as an issue around Holland and support for Holland and Holland being in the final?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the brilliant things about this World Cup was after South Africa's own team, Bafana Bafana, were eliminated, the whole of South Africa swung behind Ghana, who eventually were the only remaining representatives of the African continent left in the tournament. And that was fascinating to see. You know, there was a sense to begin with, oh, this is just a bit of PR, you know, a bit of kind of pan-African solidarity public relations hype. But, you know, I talked to lots of people of all kinds, black and white, poor and rich, old and young, and just everybody had swung behind Ghana. And that applied to the Afrikaners, to the descendants of the Dutch settlers of the, I guess, 17th and 18th centuries. I think for Afrikaners now, who speak a language that is a kind of distant variant of Dutch, their Dutch roots are a long way away. I think now that, you know, after Ghana had gone out and, you know, everybody's choosing a side between Spain and Holland, I think inevitably, I noticed in Cape Town at the semi-final, lots of South Africans were choosing Holland, and I guess probably the Dutchness would have something to do with that. But it was just fascinating when Ghana was still here, how absolutely wholehearted they were in supporting them, and how genuine that seemed. That could never happen in Europe. You know, if England were eliminated from a World Cup, you know, the English aren't going to start supporting Germany or France or Italy. That's absolutely unthinkable.
Right.
But
right.
Here it just seemed the most natural thing in the world and very healthy, I thought.
I'm speaking with Richard Williams. He's the chief sports writer for The Guardian. And I want to close out with just one or two questions here. I noticed that you used to write on for the Melody Maker, so I assume for on popular music, rock music. Back in the day. And I grew up, reading almost religiously Greil Marcus, Lester Bangs, Robert Christgau, the great American rock critics from the 70s, 60s, even into the early 80s, and then also reading the British journals, New Musical Express, Melody Maker. And to me, this was one way in which I, with the music and then these writers, these authors, really were reflecting on the state of the sort of cutting edge of the culture that I was a part of, reflecting on the world. And now I, like yourself, I'm doing a soccer show, The People's Game. You're writing on football for The Guardian. And it strikes me that the sort of cultural hegemony of rock music has very much faded over the past 25 years in English and American culture. And soccer has become huge globally, is ever bigger than in England, and certainly now starting to penetrate the United States as the most significant shared cultural entity in the world. As a writer, do you find that some of what you brought for cultural illumination when you used to write on music is now something that you bring to bear on your writing in football?
It's a tough question, but I hope so very much. What I find with sport, and I've always found, you know, I've loved it since I was a kid, is what I used to find, still do to a degree, but probably less so now in music, which is the sense of spontaneity and unpredictability. You know, I used to love going to a gig and not knowing what was going to happen. Nowadays, I think people tend to give you much more of what they think they know you want. Which you've already heard, you know, most people play their latest album and a few hits. That didn't used to happen so much, but I find sport you know, there's nothing as exhilarating as going into an empty stadium on the day when something big is about to happen. I mean, I'm lucky, you know, I get the kind of ticket that allows me to go in really early. And I love just going in to a completely empty bowl. This is going to happen on Sunday, you know, that is going to fill up over the course of the next few hours with 80 or 90,000 people, none of whom knows what's going to happen next. And that's what I used to love about music. And sport has that, and it, you know, will always have it, I hope.
I see there's one question that I didn't ask, and I want to go back to before I ask you to play the octopus, as it were, and talk about what you think will happen on Sunday, which is Johan Cruyff. It seems almost as much as any point in the course of his lifetime, this is his moment. When for people who aren't familiar, and of course there's a lot of Americans listening here who may not know the detailed history of football from the past century, Cruyff has sort of moved into a position in the pantheon of all-time soccer greats where he's generally mentioned third. Okay, there are great players, Garrincha, Eusebio, who also get mentioned in that territory. But it seems that Pelé and Maradona have sort of occupied this status, and there's the debate, who's the greatest player of all time? And, of course, they won World Cups, or a World Cup in Maradona's case, and competed very much for others. Cruyff didn't, only really played in one World Cup, and yet he has this status. And he's somewhat of a sort of cagey, mysterious figure, and I just want to get you to reflect on Johan Cruyff a little bit, his career, his character, and both on the field and off the field as a manager.
Well, Cruyff as a player was like a kind of blinding flash of light when you saw him, like seeing Pelé for the first time. But the difference was, if you were in Britain, like I was, that here was a European doing that. You know, before we'd seen Pelé and Di Stefano, who were essentially South Americans. Cruyff played with a degree of freedom and a sort of, I don't know, a kind of sense of liberated values that fitted very much with the time, with the late 60s. You know, Total Football came out of Amsterdam, a sort of hippie haven, and reflected a lot of those values. And Cruyff was the figurehead of that. He was a very kind of dashing figure. He fitted into that kind of late 60s, early 70s mold. I wish we'd seen more of him. I wish he'd, as a player, in a way, I wish he'd sort of stuck around a little bit longer. And I wish he'd gone to the 1978 World Cup. Nobody's ever been exactly sure why he didn't, whether it was politics, internal Dutch football politics, or whether the story he'd had death threats against his family. That having not managed to lead Holland to victory in 74, that would have been his moment. Although, it would have denied us a fantastic victory for Argentina, which was sort of extraordinary, and wouldn't want to have been without that. But went on and he...
It's the one final I regret the most. I mean, I don't tend to, in a petty way, always bring my politics to bear, but I've always viewed the 78 tournament as a corruption that exceeded the other corruptions.
As tainted by the generals.
Yes.
Yeah, of course, you know, you could see that at the time. That was certainly true, but they had such marvelous players, you know, right. Kempes and Ardiles and Luque and Pazzarella, that it was very hard to see them as simply the symbols of a military dictatorship. You know, they were great footballers and a great team,
right.
And they played with such a sense of kind of panache that, in a way, they seemed more like a people's team than a you know, a general's team. I thought that's what I felt at the time. Anyway, Cruyff didn't go and deprived himself of that. Of course, you know, he was became a great figure in Spain and identified with the team of Catalonia, Barcelona, mm-hmm. and became a kind of presiding deity there, if you like, in the way that Alfredo Di Stefano has always been at Real Madrid. And you know, I think any Barcelona coach sort of operates with one eye on Cruyff, wondering what Cruyff's thinking of him, you know, wondering whether he's doing the right thing in those senses. as I'm sure Pep Guardiola has been doing. He, you know, he's not afraid to speak his mind, Cruyff. I think he said, you know, he said fairly disparaging things about recent Dutch teams. You know, he's quite a harsh judge in a way. It'll be a, you wouldn't mind being in his head on Sunday afternoon to know exactly what he's thinking, where his sympathies lie, because he's, you know, he's been in Spain and been, you know, an intimate of that, of the Catalan, the great Catalan club for so long, but, you know, his sympathies must be divided.
Yeah, he did come out with a statement today saying that it is a little ambiguous, but the positive glowing things are said about Spain. But it begins with him saying that I think his heart is with Holland, but, and it goes from there. And then the balance of the content is about how beautiful Spain plays, and they play in the true legacy of Dutch
football. I guess he can't lose. You can say that.
Yeah, I suppose. It would be interesting to see. But again, who knows? Again, and he is quite coy in terms of when he does speak out and what kind of interviews he grants and such.
Yes.
And so on to the big event. And I find it almost impossible to predict this match. I suppose I feel Spain are the favorites. And yet my heart is sort of with Holland, but that's more of a legacy thing than it has to do with actual players on the field. I find Spain to play utterly beautiful football when they're on. I hate to be so agnostic on it, but I suppose I'm pulling slightly for Holland, and I expect Spain to slightly win. And what do you think?
Well, we neutrals can't lose. We're going to get a new winner of the World Cup, whatever happens, which is an exciting thought. If Spain played brilliantly, they'll win. And Holland will have to play brilliantly to beat them. So, you know, that's good. If Holland win, we'll have, you know, we'll be able to honor Wesley Sneijder for winning something unprecedented over the course of this season. All the trophies available to him with Internazionale in Italy, the European Cup and the World Cup, you know, which is just an amazing thing. And he deserves it because he's, you know, undoubtedly been the preeminent single figure in world football over the last season. So it'll be, you know, and he doesn't show any signs of being overawed by that. So I think he'll perform on Sunday, and he could win the match for them. But there are, you know, there are a lot of match winners on the pitch there. You know, Arjen Robben could decide it. We're waiting for Robin van Persie to produce the performance that we know he's capable of. You know, he may just be running back into form at the right moment this weekend. But then Holland have got David Villa, who's been absolutely lethal. And they've got the wonderful duo of Xavi Hernandez and Andres Iniesta, who are just, you know, it's like watching somebody write poetry.
And not a lot has been made of it, but I do think the Dutch goalie has been a little shaky recently. Obviously capable of playing well, but with Casillas across the field from him, you'd have to tip that to Spain as well.
Yes, you would. I thought Stekelenburg, you know, almost certainly should have done better with Diego Forlán's goal in the semi-final. That can't have done much for his self-confidence, but then he's got those, you know, six defenders in front of him keeping the attackers at bay. So who knows what's going to happen.
Well, Richard Williams, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I suppose I got one final question to draw out from you, which is you're going to be at the stadium, Soccer City in Johannesburg. You'll probably get there early. What does it feel like in the build-up to a World Cup final? It's the cultural spectacle that more people will be watching, more human consciousnesses focused upon than probably any event in our lifetime, because these get bigger and bigger and bigger. I've argued throughout this show that the only thing that approximates it is the U.S. presidential election evening. And so how does that feel? I mean, you must have been there in Berlin
in
2006.
Well, yeah, the thing that I would compare it to is the Olympic men's 100 meters. When, you know, that's the thing that only lasts 9 seconds and change, whereas you know, a football match lasts a minimum of 90 minutes plus half time. but you get the same sense of fantastic anticipation, terrific, just a terrific build-up in the stadium, absolutely buzzing. You don't need any of that kind of fanfare stuff that FIFA insists on having, you know, the sort of iconization of the ball, for instance, which I find rather depressing, or the anthems or the flags or any of that. All you need is the football match. And I think the Soccer City Stadium is absolutely the right arena for it. It's a very, very spectacular building indeed. And, you know, there will be 90-odd thousand in there. You will feel that the eyes of the world are on it. There's no doubt about that. And I just hope it doesn't go to penalties for that reason. I think it's unbearable for the individual players to be put through that. I don't mind it going to extra time at all, but I hope it's settled by a proper goal in proper open play.
Yes, it would be nice if they had a special rule, since they seem to be playing around with special rules. They don't allow that to ever happen in the final. I rooted for the Azzurri in 94 right here, and it was terrible, truly terrible. Yeah. But Richard Williams, thank you so much for your time. And Richard Williams is the chief sports writer for The Guardian. You can find his writings at guardian.co.uk. Thank you for joining us on The People's Game.
Thank you, Alan. Great pleasure.